Shrink Wrap Radio number 447, Finding Your Groove at Home and Work with Dr. Christine Carter.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with social psychologist and happiness expert, Dr. Christine Carter, who's also the author of the 2015 book, The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Work and Home. For more information about Dr. Christine Carter, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Christine Carter, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm so pleased to have you on the show. I've been aware of you and your work for a long time. I've been a member of the Greater Good Science Center ever since I attended a workshop on positive psychology and health by Dacher Keltner, whom I also interviewed here. So I've seen your name for some time in periodic postings to members from the Greater Good Science Center. And do I recall correctly that you were executive director there up until fairly recently?
Yes, I was the executive director there for many, many years, although I haven't been for a few years now. But we love our members, so thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of jealous in a way because I was so impressed by Dacher that I was tempted to approach him for some kind of job there or even a volunteer position.
Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful organization. And I'm glad that you're participating by going to the workshops. And, you know, it's really important for us. Our mission is to, spread the word about all this science and translate it for the general public. So in a way, you are a volunteer.
it's true. And I've interviewed a number of people who, you know, have been interviewed there or who've written books that are featured there and so on. So recognized or not, I am a volunteer member. So thank you for that recognition. Now, before we get into your current book, The Sweet Spot, I note that you wrote a previous book titled Raising Happiness, which I assume was strongly influenced by the positive psychology movement.
It was, although I really started working on that as a doctoral student in sociology. So it all kind of began before positive psychology had gotten off the ground.
Yeah.
I just feel it's just so wonderful how it's all developed in the last 10 years. But I am trained as a sociologist, not a psychologist, and that's been really fun for me because the big difference is that my interest as a sociologist is more about how our culture and our social structures, like our families or the businesses that we interact with or work for, influence how we feel. All social structures or cultures are going to tend to foster certain behaviors and emotions that go along with them and inhibit others. And we aren't often all that conscious of the forces outside of our brains.
That's right. Well, your remarks trigger several questions for me here. And one is, how did you become attracted to positive psychology?
Well, I mean, really, I was already studying the sociology of happiness and other positive emotions, before the positive psychology movement, before I even knew about it, right? Before the positive psychology movement started as a pretty insular group of people who were very influential and good at what they did, but they didn't have a lot of interaction with sociology until they really became widespread.
Yeah. Do you remember how you heard about it first?
How I heard about positive psychology first? Well, Dacher Keltner was one of my dissertation advisors.
So I
started to hear about the work that he was doing and the interaction that we were having. And then as the executive director of the Greater Good Science Center, we started talking about, it was a real question for us. How were we going to be different than than what was happening at Penn?
Yeah.
And how could we support their work, but then also distinguish ourselves? And the answer was that, we always said, okay, well, we do West Coast positive psychology, which is more sociological, actually, in the sense that it's more about how we can influence the community and the culture. There's more emphasis on compassion and empathy and interpersonal kinds of emotions, and less on self-improvement, generally speaking. I mean, and it's evolved. I think we've become more similar over the years, but that was the original thinking.
Fascinating. And by the way, I was an undergraduate at Penn, but that was long before positive psychology was even a gleam in anybody's eye. But still, I like to claim the affiliation now.
Well, it's such a great affiliation, right? It's just such a wonderful movement that really was born there.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you're a sociologist by training. And it makes me wonder, is there a parallel movement of what you might call positive sociology?
There is. We don't call it positive sociology, though. We call it public sociology. And I don't know that they would say, oh, yes, we're a parallel movement, but they are. Uh-huh. I often get called out as when I get claimed as a public sociologist by this group. And it's more about, how we can do sociology that improves the public's lives, right? So that brings something positive to the public, and that it's not always immediately obvious why it's positive, right? Because sociology it's not necessarily the same as psychology in the sense that it's always been, psychology has been more focused on
pathology
and dysfunction, right? And
yes.
In the same way, sociology has been focused on pathology and dysfunction at the societal level, right? So that there is the parallel there, but there is a slight difference in that the public sociologists are not necessarily just studying positive emotions or positivity in society. Though they are looking at what makes strong communities strong and what makes happy schools happy, for example. They definitely care about that, but it's more, they're still studying what I think of as the isms,
right.
Racism and sexism and all the things, but then looking at how we can make improvements, how we can grow.
Now, you also used to work in marketing.
I did.
Yeah. What sorts of company or products were you working with, if I may ask?
I worked, I got my start in marketing in a family business, a family olive business that my great-grandfather started. But then I went to work after college for the Quaker Oats Company. And I worked on a lot of different types of products in the cereals, organic cereals, but then also Cap'n Crunch. So, which is funny because I've got four kids and I do not feed them Cap'n Crunch.
Well, you must have done a good job because I eat a bowl of old-fashioned Quaker oatmeal every morning.
Yeah. Well, I it's interesting because I am a relatively good at marketing. And so now I just say I'm now in the business of marketing ideas that will help the world rather than products.
Yeah. Well, the reason I wanted to ask you about marketing is I've had a parallel career as a market research consultant for many years. And a few years ago, I gave a presentation at a conference in Prague to the effect that it seemed to me that marketers and major corporations were grabbing hold of positive psychology. For example, Coca-Cola's Open Happiness campaign. BMW had one called We Make Joy. Sears has one called Life Well Spent. Dove had the True Colors campaign. MasterCard has Things Money Can't Buy. Starbucks, What If We're Not Separate, and Allstate, Protect the Basics, and finally Kaiser Permanente, Thrive. What's your impression about that? Do you think I'm on the right track? Do you think marketers have been tapping into ideas from positive psychology?
Oh, gosh. Yes, absolutely. I mean, they're not even trying to hide the fact that they're tapping into these ideas. I get calls every week from major brands who want me to help them with this. And I, you know, and so here's the thing. It's funny because, I mean, I moved from brand management and consumer product marketing into what I'm doing now because I didn't feel good about the type of marketing that I was doing. It just wasn't, you know, I knew when we were trying to market Cap'n Crunch to toddlers that there was something off, right?
It
didn't have integrity to me.
Right.
And I've kind of, and I don't, you know, I do some work, a little tiny bit of work with some brands occasionally because, I've come around to the idea that, that this is something that, is not going away. And, our media and our advertising culture is so dominant. You know, I mean, I just read this morning, the average person sees 500 ads a day. So those ads are having some influence on our, not just our culture, but also our individual psyches.
Sure.
And so it's become important to me for these brands to get it right, right? So I think that, you know, this media and advertising culture is for the most part leading people down the wrong path, right? They're saying this will make you happier. And if you, you know, have the latest skinny jeans or longer eyelashes or this sort of car, and, you know, it's almost deliberately confusing people, in terms of what the road to happiness really is, right?
Yeah.
And particularly it really lacks integrity now that we know what brings happiness and, you know, we have these companies that are advertising directly to our children.
That's a particular concern. And I know it must be to you both as a marketer who's savvy to this stuff and as a mother.
Yeah, I know. I had this terrible experience the other day where we have rules. My kids like to watch sports on TV. They're all preteens and teenagers. And I don't mind them watching sports, but I do mind them watching commercials. And so it's like this sort of this thing back and forth where it's like, I want them to record it and fast forward through it, but then they know what happens at the end of the game when they, you know what I mean? Like it's a tough thing, right? I understand why they don't really want to do that. And, so I said, okay, well, how about we compromise and you mute the, commercial. So at least you're not listening to it and it'll encourage you to talk to each other or do something else while you wait.
Well, good for you.
Well, no, listen, this is, so they made a game out of it. They're like, yeah, that's fun. And, with it on mute, then they decided that they actually only needed to see the first 5 seconds of the ad and they could then tell you exactly what the product was and why you should buy it.
Oh my goodness.
Right. They're like, and the reason that State Farm is good is, and the reason that, well, you know what I mean? It was so, here's these kids who I've let watch. They've had so little exposure. I mean, as much as I could possibly control, they don't ever watch TV. They don't, you know, except for the sports thing. And they already had every single message.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, I don't want to say it's all universally bad because then I shut myself out from actually engaging in what isn't necessarily, you know, I mean, I think like, for example, Kaiser Permanente is spending millions of dollars on an advertising campaign, which actually might help people be healthier and happier. It might actually help people thrive, right?
Yes, yes.
So that's very different than Coca-Cola's campaign, which is just a total sham, right? I mean, yeah. Drink happiness or whatever the heck their thing is. It drives me crazy because they are using the word happiness and the concept of happiness. And and what happens in people's brain is they think, you know, it basically helps them conflate pleasure, the pleasure of getting a massive sugar hit while you drink chemical, you know, sugar, whatever. And that gratification that comes from that, the triggering of the reward system in your brain, and actual happiness. You know, that's just, we don't need, our kids are in trouble enough as it is, in terms of happiness. We do not need, you know, these messages that you can just buy or eat or drink something and lead a happier life.
Yeah. My kids are grown now, but I do have grandkids, and boy, our culture just does not support parenting very much.
Mm-mm.
So it's a real challenge. But hey, let's move on to your book. not that this is totally tangential, because
no,
it certainly,
not at all.
Yeah, it certainly does relate. The full title of your book is The Sweet Spot: How to Find Your Groove at Home and Work. How did you come to write this book?
Well, I will tell you the story. Maybe I can just sort of read the first couple paragraphs, because do a little reading from the book that explains it, and then we can get into the nitty gritty.
Yeah, that would be great. And if there are any other points where you want to read or tell stories, please do, so that people really get a feeling both for your style of writing and we all know how much story and personal anecdotes is good for hooking the brain.
yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I might skip around a little bit then in this introduction.
Sure.
And just do a little reading. All right. This book arose like a phoenix as an experiment in having it all. Could I fulfill my career potential and have a fulfilling family life? Could I be a great parent and still attend to my own needs? Could I be successful and happy without also feeling stressed and anxious? Having studied well-being and elite performance for the past decade, I've long known what to do to be both happy and successful. After all, I coach people from all over the world on these topics. But to be totally honest, in my day-to-day life, I used to struggle to walk the talk. 5 years ago, I was a single mother holding down 3 demanding part-time jobs, and my life was a blur. Yes, our family did find a way to eat dinner together most nights, and we talked about what we were grateful for. In some ways, I practiced what I preached, but in other ways, I was caught up in the busyness of modern life. Winded, running on a hamster wheel, afraid to slow down. I'd lost my groove.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that really says it. How did you get so caught up in being on that treadmill in the first place?
Well, you know, I had work I really loved as a parenting and life coach, and then as the executive director and as a sociologist at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, as we were talking about. But I was also a keynote speaker, and I was the author of Raising Happiness, and I was blogging all the time, and I had this great family life, right? So I had made it through a really amicable but still extremely difficult divorce. You know, it was just a big transition in my family life.
Yeah.
And so I was at this place where everything in my life was incredibly hard won, right? I was very happy with my family life. I was very happy with my career. And I didn't want to give any of it up, but I was so tired all the time. I mean, I just could not seem to get enough sleep. And for me, I caught every virus on every airplane. You know, when you're really tired, it's very hard to stay healthy. And I just, I mean, really, I was really sick all the time. When I say, like, it wasn't just like I had a lot of colds. I had a strep throat infection that lasted for 18 months, 9 courses of antibiotics.
Oh, my goodness.
Still freaking had strep throat, right? I really just had lost the ability to heal. And so it wasn't that I was, you know, I had anything life threatening or, you know, it was just this sort of low grade illness all the time that then I hit rock bottom really in a day or two when I had had surgery on my throat. And then I like really struggled to recover from that. And I thought I was kind of recovered. And then all of a sudden, boom, I had another major infection and I ended up in the ER because my fever was so high and I was in so much pain. I had a kidney infection of all things, which I mean, kidney infections are really painful. And I just had this moment where I was like, please admit me to the hospital. I'm supposed to get on a plane tomorrow to Atlanta to give another talk. I'm too tired. I just need to recover. Like, do you really have to just give me those antibiotics as a shot? Can't I have IV antibiotics? Do you know what I mean? I was begging the doctor to admit me into the hospital.
Yeah, you used a term in the book that I had never heard before called hospital fantasies.
Yeah. Yeah. I had heard about hospital fantasies before.
Of actually wishing that you'd be sick enough to get kind of a forced rest, a forced vacation in the hospital.
Yeah, you know, here, I'm going to read again from my book because I think a lot of people don't know what a hospital fantasy is. So, not familiar with the concept of hospital fantasies? I was nearly as tired as this woman who wrote on Katrina Alcorn's Working Moms Break blog. I stumbled back to work when my son was 6 weeks old. He had colic and chronic ear infections, so I really didn't sleep for a year. No exaggeration. I would fantasize about having a minor car accident on the way to work. Nothing serious, just enough to lay me up in the hospital for a few days so that I could sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's really, it's how I felt. And I also knew, I mean, my experience of it was probably different than this woman who's writing on Katrina Alcorn's blog because I had been studying productivity and elite performance and happiness for a decade, or at this point, you know, over a decade. And here I am coaching people on it, right? I just knew I needed to get it together and that nobody's, you know, most people give me advice just like everybody else, right? So a lot of like, everybody else.
You get advice too? I find that people are less good at listening and much better at giving advice.
I know. Well, I'm guilty of that, definitely. But even like I'm a professional advice giver, basically.
Sure.
And the advice that other people would give me. This is my mom, of course, right? I can say that. Hopefully she won't listen to this. But, you know, she would always say, well, you're just going to have to give something up.
Uh-huh.
You just have to accept you can't have it all.
Uh-huh.
You think that you're better than everybody else was what she sort of was saying.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that I thought I was better than everybody else, right? I thought I was different because I had more tools. I knew that I could do it without having to give up time with my children or the work that I loved, right? That I, you know, I mean, the sort of having it all concept's very threatening to people who weren't able to have it all, like my mother, or for, well, for many groups in society that it's very threatening to see women that lead fulfilling family lives and have fulfilling and profitable careers.
Yeah. And you were enjoying so much success or are enjoying so much success that I could see where it'd be just, you know, so seductive to keep adding on more and more, you know, accepting every speaking engagement, et cetera.
Right. And that's what I did. You know, I was the executive director, and that would have been enough, right? That's enough of a job.
Actually, I felt guilty. I felt guilty reaching out to you for an interview. You know, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm putting another thing on her plate.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I'm in a really different place now than I was then, of course, because I have a whole system. So I, at that point, I knew I needed to figure it out. And figure out, you know, could I actually really have it all, or did I need to give stuff up? Did I have it wrong? And so the sweet spot is the sort of recipe book for how I figured it out. You know, it is really very much written as a guidebook because I figured it out for sure and pretty darn fast. Once I set my mind to it, I needed to go back and kind of road test everything that I was advocating everybody else do and look at some of the newer research related to it. And very occasionally some of the research seemed to conflict. And so there were some things I needed to work out, but mostly I needed to change my habits and learn how to say no But, you know, here's the thing. People say, okay, so what did you do? You had to give up a lot. I did not give up anything that brought me joy. Nothing. Mm-hmm. It was not simply I slowed down and I had to give this, and this up. Yeah, it's true. I'm not the executive director of the Greater Good Science Center anymore, but guess what? That didn't bring me joy. I did it because I love the organization and I was good at it. I was good at fundraising. I was good at writing strategic plans. But it wasn't, my heart wasn't in it for any other reason. I felt like I should do it because I had the ability to do it and because it was prestigious. But I wasn't doing it because it gave me the sense of like, oh, goody, I get to go into the office today and write a strategic plan, right? Oh. That's not what I wanted to be doing.
Yeah.
So yes, I did give things up, but nothing that brings ease or strength or joy into my life. And guess what? I mean, it was terrifying. I got to tell you, it was that there's a whole chapter in this book on courage because that was part of what I needed to do, right? I needed to figure out how to be more courageous in my life. It took me forever to step down as the executive director and even longer to sort of dial back some of my other involvement there to where I was just doing what I wanted to do. It was very scary. I had never not had a steady income the way that job provided me, and moving to more of a, you know, I have a very different relationship with the center now, and I had to move to sort of different revenue models and do, you know, more of the coaching, which I love, and speaking, which do bring me much more joy, right? Well, guess what? My income is five times what it was.
Wow. So there's a real endorsement for following your bliss.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that we're always going to get paid for our hobbies. You know, I definitely think we need to follow our bliss, but I think that the millennials tend to be a little bit confused about the difference between, I just think that it's not possible to always be able to make a living by doing what your hobby is, right? Yeah. But I actually had already like an incredibly proven career in all of these things. I knew how to make the money. I just, by shifting where I was spending my time, the money did follow. I mean, I'm also a much more prolific writer, and I love that, right? So by any measure, not just income, my career has really taken off. I'm also spending more time with my children, not less. And it's just, or more, a higher quality time. I mean, I'm spending slightly less time driving them around and helping them with homework because that was an area which they wanted somebody else to be doing some of that stuff. And that has freed up more time for me to just not be multitasking when I'm with them.
Yeah, that's great. One of the things that you emphasize for finding the sweet spot is to take a recess, which is an appropriate metaphor for someone who's worked with parents and children as much as you have. I remember as a kid in school, recess was the thing we looked forward to with great excitement all day. But what does taking a recess mean in this context?
It means shifting the type of brain activity, really, is what it is, right? So our brains most of us understand that when we go to sleep at night, for example, our brains shift between different sleep patterns, different types of brain waves, right? We have five stages of sleep, and each is characterized by a different type of brain activity. And, sure. And if we don't get some type of one of those stages, I actually don't know that much about it. I'm just using it as a metaphor. Right. We end up being tired during the day, or we don't process our emotions or whatever, right? So what people don't realize is that our brains are not that different when we're awake, right? We need different types of brain activity. And we think of our brains like computers. You switch it on, you should be able to focus, run multiple apps at any one given time, right? It's not true, right? Our brains have rhythms during the day, and they need to fluctuate between periods of focus, periods of daydreaming, periods of play, when we force ourselves to just keep focusing, and then we experience a dip in our energy, we get tired, we have a cup of coffee instead, and then we force ourselves to go back to work, stare at the screen. We basically induce a type of jet lag in ourselves, right? We understand that if we don't get the right kind of sleep, or we travel to a different time zone, our brain has a hard time functioning well.
What sorts of recesses did you create in your life?
Well, so the first thing was that just that concept of taking a break while I was working. I set an alarm. I work for about 45 or 50 minutes now, sometimes up to an hour if I'm really in the flow. And then I take about a 10 or 20 minute break. Uh-huh. And I will walk outside because sunlight really helps. And I live in California. throw the ball for my jog, or I will, read an article of interest, because curiosity is it just can't be on a task list, right? It has to count. It's sort of like adult play, you know? So, if I read something that I've been really curious about, that can, rejuvenate you. You know, it's really important to just give ourselves time to stare into space and let our minds wander. So,
you know what? I'm supposedly retired. And and I have trouble doing what you're talking about.
Yeah. So have time. You have time to do it, but our culture. Okay. So there's this, I think one of the biggest, most pernicious myths in our culture is that busyness is a sign of importance. Mm-hmm. And so when we, even if we intellectually know it's really, our brains are really going to benefit from staring into space, and I can talk a little bit more about why our brains benefit from that. But if we're going to, we might intellectually know that, but we feel as though, well, if busyness is a sign of significance and importance and productivity and success, then staring into space or letting my mind wander, not only is it wasting time, and time is money, and we hate that feeling, right? That causes anxiety. But also, not being busy makes us feel the opposite of, you know, we feel unimportant and unproductive and insignificant, right? And all of that creates a lot of anxiety for us. Now, even once if we intellectually know that these things aren't true, like we all know really significant people doing very important work in the world who are not busy. They do not multitask. They aren't overwhelmed. They have plenty of time to just stare into space, right? I was just speaking at the Wisdom 2.0 conference this last weekend, and they're all there, right? Those people all there, you know, really inspiring to hear these really great neuroscientists and political leaders and spiritual leaders talking about the way they spend their time. And believe me, they're not busy. And by the same token, we all know plenty of people who are busy and overwhelmed and multitasking who aren't particularly productive. You know, it's paralyzing to be busy.
And so I think that I'm just thinking about myself, and, and generalizing from there. And I'm thinking about maybe a lot of it, the busyness is driven by anxiety, you know, by anxiety of of not being successful, not being enough, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, yes. So these anxious feelings come up, maybe even feelings of guilt, right? That you feel lazy or whatever. And then I think that we have to pair that. If you look at what's happened in our society, so I'm, you know, sitting here at my desk. I know I should just take a little break and stare out the window, but then the anxiety rises up that I need to keep being productive. I need to keep doing stuff. And all I have to do is turn my, you know, my head back to my computer and look at, check my email. Or maybe I'm just standing in line at the grocery store and I feel, start to feel guilty for not being productive at that very moment. So I can just pull my computer out of my pocket, basically.
Yes, right. We have a computer on us all the time now.
Yeah. And so we can make ourselves busy and productive at any time. And so it's that, right? So I think, thinking about the ability to just daydream and let your brain rest. I still also, I want to come back. We have to talk about what actually happens in your brain when you're doing that, because important things happen. But, you know, that's a skill, the ability to just, you know, be a passenger on a commuter train and look out the window.
Yeah.
You know,
it's, instead of having your laptop out and working on the report that you have to write, you used a beautiful phrase in the book, full plate, empty life. That's pretty strong language.
Yeah, it is. But that's where we end up, right? We are busy and overwhelmed, but our lives feel empty. Because here's what happens. So we feel the anxiety come up, we check our phones. Let's just say that that's, or we're, you know, we're at a red light while driving and we feel like it's a good time to be productive. And so then we quickly check our messages, right?
Yeah.
So that, and that's actually a really effective way to numb those feelings of anxiety that come up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
You feel anxious, you get back to being busy and quote unquote productive. It's not real productivity, but you feel that way. And the emotion goes away. Now, here's the thing about the human experience, the brain. We cannot selectively numb certain emotions. It doesn't, if I'm numbing out that anxiety or that guilt or the uncomfortable thought that arose at the red light, I am also effectively numbing out all the emotions. So the profound joy that might have come when, you know, on the next block, I picked my children up from school, or the great gratitude that comes and produces a nice warm feeling in our chest when we see something heartwarming out the window as we're sitting at the light, right? We numb all of our emotions. So as Louis C.K. says, we never really feel happy. We never really feel sad. We just feel kind of satisfied with our product. And then we die, right? Mm. That is the sort of, and what's happening is that we no longer really enjoy the lives that we have worked so hard to create.
Right. Now you've got a chapter called the stress/success tipping point, and we're all familiar with the tipping point concept from Malcolm Gladwell's book, but tell us what you're getting at there.
Well, there's also a psychological tipping point at the individual level where when you have about three positive emotions to every one negative emotion or even experience or interaction. So in terms of, you know, three positive experiences to one negative. And these things could be just a fleeting, you know, feeling of gratitude, for example, or anger or whatever. When that ratio gets above 3-1 for most people, something dramatic happens in our brain and our functioning. So there is a real shift in terms of like the areas of your brain that are getting oxygenated, are getting the right or an optimal amount of blood sugar. It changes changes your perception of the world literally in terms of, you know, how it broadens your perspective. So your peripheral vision actually becomes more crisp. But then it also figuratively broadens your perception in terms of the way we take in information. You're able to see context better, more able to see the forest for the trees. So lots of things start to happen where you're more able to think creatively to come up with an innovative solution to a problem, particularly a problem that requires some form of insight. We become more verbally fluent, more able to empathize with other people, to see other people's needs and then meet them. So, I mean, lots of really wonderful things happen. And so,
what triggers that? Is it focusing on
emotions? So having three positive emotions to every one negative. So the interesting thing about that is that it's not just about positive thinking and having lots of positive thoughts. It's really about the ratio, right? Life is really difficult. And those difficult emotions that come with some of life's challenges or maybe even traumas are also really important. They're important for, we think of them as like the bottom half of a sailboat, right? The keel of a ship. It helps keep us balanced and steer in the right direction. It's not, but the positive emotions, the sails, basically, you know, that's what puts wind in our sails and creates motion and growth.
So how do you make sure you're getting those positive emotions more than a 3-to-1 ratio?
Well, we actively foster them, right? So you might be going through a difficult time where you're experiencing a lot of challenging or uncomfortable emotions. And we make sure that you are also doing what it takes to bring in positive emotions. So if you'll indulge me, I will sort of broaden. Most people just think about happiness, right? And as we already spoke about earlier in the interview, we tend to conflate happiness with pleasure and gratification. And that's actually not what we're talking about at all. So happiness or a sense of cheerfulness or joy, which is probably a more profound positive emotion, takes place in the present. And it can go with contentment or engagement or passion. But we also need to think about positive emotions about the past, like gratitude or appreciation, which I've mentioned, or the future, like optimism, faith, hope. Confidence can be a very positive emotion about the future. And then, of course, our most powerful positive emotions are actually about other people. So love and compassion and positive emotions that are more global in nature. I actually find them to be really easy to access, like awe, inspiration, and elevation, right? Mm-hmm. So let's look at those last three, the global positive emotions. I love them because we study them at the Greater Good Science Center. And I find them easy to access because, so I feel a real sense of awe, for example, out in nature. And I happen to live in an area in Northern California where there's a beautiful hike and there's a beautiful vista and I can just, there's this like area where there are all these ferns and these redwood trees and I feel a sense of awe every time I do it. And I cultivate that. So how do I feel awe? I go on this hike because I know for me, that's what works. If I don't have time to go for a hike, I have bookmarked on my computer, my YouTube channel. And actually my entire website every Friday, I post videos that I feel that make me cry, basically, that inspire me. They create this sense of elevation that are, usually it's, watching people do inspiring things and it cultivates this emotional state of elevation and inspiration. And that's how we do it, right? So people are like, really? You're just going to like advocate that we sit and watch YouTube videos? Yeah, right? Funny animal videos. If that makes you laugh, that's a positive emotion.
Yeah, puppies. Right?
I know those baby laughing.
Laughing like, babies, yeah. And puppies. I love them.
Right. And what people should know is that researchers use little YouTube videos all the time to cultivate positive emotions before they study them. I mean, they literally show a measurable change in people's functioning after they've watched a puppy play in a field of, a little field for a couple of minutes or watched a video of a whale that is so, it's awesome, right? To give them sort of scale or, you know, so, I mean, there's really something to it. And it's not as, you know, this is fun. I'm adding things to your task list that are fun to do and will, improve your functioning so that life feels easier, right? The hard, and that's the whole goal. The title of my book is The Sweet Spot. And I got that. The sweet spot to me is the overlap between where we have our greatest ease in our life and where we have our greatest strengths, right? So many of us are used to, you know, the assumption, we assume that we will only get where we want to go in life. This was certainly my assumption, by making a really powerful effort, right?
Yes.
I'm so focused on the constant effort and my high pain tolerance. But the sweet spot's really about finding our place of effortless power. Right? It's not always about making a more powerful effort. That doesn't mean that I don't try very hard at anything anymore. Of course I do. But I'm all that effort that I'm making is always the end game for me now always is in developing effortless power where I don't feel resistance. I don't feel stress. I just feel the sort of ease and my own strength.
Well, I love that word ease, and related to that, I think you talk about developing the ability to be more reliant on your autopilot.
Yes.
What is this autopilot? I think I know, but I'd love to hear you talk.
It is the ultimate form of ease. I love our brain has this incredible capacity to run on autopilot. You know, our habits basically are our autopilot, and so much of our brain activity and our behaviors during the day are run by this part of our brain that that is responsible for our habits. And neuroscience has developed enough in the last 5 to 7 years that we understand how that part of our brain responsible for our habits or autopilot is programmed. Right. So this is, we can write the code for our habits. And this is a really important thing actually for us to, learn how to do, I think, because so many of us waste so much of our time, and energy, really. It's more a waste of our energy just making decisions and trying to get through things that can be just routine, right? So I watch this all the time with people's morning routines. They wake up and they check their email before they even get out of bed, right? And then they're already racing, like, okay, should I respond to that email or should I take a shower? Should I make my coffee or should I skip my exercise? Should I, you know, and you know, I got to tell you, my morning routine, it might be boring, but it is predictable. I always meditate. I always do my exercise. And I do it all in the same order, and I do it with no effort whatsoever anymore because I've just programmed that part of my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Why exert a big effort getting yourself to exercise if you can just program yourself to do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have my own autopilot story. As I mentioned earlier, I used to be involved in market research, conducting focus groups for corporations. And in the early days, I would panic at some point near the end of the group or right after it, realizing that I've been so immersed in the process, you know, kind of in the here and now of the group that I couldn't remember the specifics of what had been said. And so I'd be flashing ahead to the fact that I would have to write a detailed report. But with experience, I learned to relax and just turn it over to my unconscious and to sleep on it and to trust that the next day, the key meanings of the research would become clear.
Yes.
And that's been a major learning in my life, to just turn it over to the sleeping brain and not worry about it. And then the next day, there's so much more clarity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, so you bring up a really good point there, and that is that we assume that nothing happens for us unless we put that effort towards it, right? That it's like this idea of the sleeping brain. One of the reasons that it's so important to give ourselves those recesses that we were talking about and really honestly give ourselves time to daydream and just stare into space while we're waiting in line or whatever we're doing, or just taking a break, is that a part of our brain comes online when we're daydreaming that cannot be active when we're focused on something. And that part of our brain is responsible for our creative insights. So our insights are, you know, a great source of this sort of sweet spot ease and strength, right? Yes. So you allowing your brain, you know, we have to trust that most of our brain activity is actually unconscious, and your brain is hard at work all the time. If we're just staring into space, it doesn't mean that our brain is just like, you know, we're flatlining or something, right? You know what I mean? Like mixing metaphors there, but still it doesn't mean that nothing is happening. It's something different is happening. And so, I mean, it's almost a cliche, but I feel like we need to remind people, you know, so think about the last super innovative solution you came up to to solve a problem. Where did you come up with it? Ask anybody about this. And 99% of the time, they will say they came up with that idea in the shower. Right?
I was just about to say that. For me, it's definitely the shower.
Okay, well, think about that. You know, what does the shower have that the rest of our lives doesn't have anymore? Like, most people don't bring their phones, their smartphones, into the shower.
I've thought about it.
I know, right? And most people don't have radios in their shower. It's the only time during the day that we reliably have to just stare into space.
Yeah.
Daydream. And when we do that, our brain starts forming neural connections between things that we didn't previously see as connected. And those connections between things that we, you know, aren't necessarily connected are what really are responsible for our innovations and our insights. Yeah.
You know, I'll get a request for a quote for market research for pricing and for strategy and so on about how to approach the research. And my first impulse is to respond right away to show how responsive I am, how available I am, etc. But often I then regret after I've fired off the email, other ideas begin to occur about strategy, about pricing, and so on. And so I really have to restrain myself, and I'm kind of still in the process of learning that it's better to, instead of trying to demonstrate how available and accessible I am, to create a little bit more space.
Right. I found just having that kind of self-awareness, you know, the solution, you know, arises, right? So when you realize this, that it's, you know, important to you to be available and responsive, and it's also important to you to have time for thought, you know, you can then respond right away that says, I look forward to working on this. I'll be in touch soon, right?
Yes.
And then give yourself the time that you need to just percolate. But then, you know, where most of us fall short is that we don't really give ourselves the time that we need, in the sense that we don't give ourselves the unfocused time, right? Mm-hmm. So I try and take at least one really long walk every day. And it is always hardest when I am, you know, the most productive, or really, it's funny, the busiest, to just let myself just walk and not listen to a book on tape, listen to a podcast, call my mom back, make a bunch of calls, whatever, you know, just walk. But I've learned to do that because I need the power and the ease that comes from the insights that are generated. And I've learned to trust it, right? And what people should know is that it's not like I go for a long walk and then come back with the solutions to all my problems or all the things that I'm working on. Sometimes I end up thinking, chewing on something, you know, and I come back with all these fabulous ideas. And I, you know, make sure that I write them down, right? But more often than that, I just have to trust that something is happening in there.
Yeah.
And it's a good idea. I mean, actually, we do know a lot about creativity and insight. It's a really good idea before you give yourself that daydreaming time to present your brain with all the problems that you would like it to work out while you're not giving it any effort, right? To
yes.
sort of say, oh, I mean, so for me, the way that that looks is that I'll say, all right, I really want to write a blog post about, you know, stress in college students. And I wonder what research would be important for me to look up. And I wonder what I should say, right? That's enough. You don't have to give it any more effort than that. Mm. And then I don't consciously try it. It's also really important not to try and engage your conscious mind in it, because that's then just focus, right? That's just the part of your brain that we already know how to access. You need to let it happen unconsciously. And so just let your mind wander. You know, if you feel anxious, let yourself feel how you feel, right?
Yes.
Notice the anxiety and the guilt that comes up with some curiosity and definitely a healthy dose of acceptance. It's normal. It's normal in our culture. You've been taught your whole life that if you're not being productive in the way, you know, focusing on something, actively doing something, that you're unimportant and insignificant. Of course you feel anxious. You know, it's normal. But just let yourself feel it. And for me, I am able to bring humor to that. I probably still feel anxious sometimes when I'm not productive, particularly if I haven't had a lot of downtime and it, you know, it's like a big gear switch that I can, it's funny that I, of all people, I'm like a daydreaming evangelist and I still, you know what I mean? Like, so I can laugh at myself and say, wow, there's that familiar feeling of anxiety. Boy, the culture has got me. You know, I am programmed, you know?
Yes, as are we all.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know, sadly, but it's the reality. And so we get to choose our response.
The word that leapt out at me in what you were saying was trust. And, you know, the learning to trust our unconscious, learning to trust that automatic pilot. And it's like a miracle, you know, that the brain is there providing these great connections, as long as we've done some due diligence ahead of time in terms of spade work and preparation, but not worrying about it.
No, the worry actually will hinder the creative insight. If you're worried or anxious, the insights won't come, because your brain knows that it doesn't have the luxury. You know, it has this old fight or flight system built into it. And that if you're under any sort of stress or threat or whatever, which just the thought that I'm insignificant, that's enough of a threat, right? So, or I'm unproductive or unsuccessful, that's a threat. And so the brain will put all its resources towards survival, which those survival resources are not very good. You can't come up with a creative insight, right? That part of your brain gets shunted. If you're in survival mode, you know, you're going to be really good at, of course, fighting or flight, you know, running away from the situation. But in order to be good at that, your brain has to shut down anything that is future-oriented, planning-oriented, that takes, you know, what we think of as executive function, or creativity. Because if you're under threat, you don't want to be slowed down by a pesky decision-making process or by brainstorming about new creative ideas for blog posts or whatever, right? You need to get the heck out of there, or you need to fight off this threat. And that is where your energy will go.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Well, given that you're a sociologist, we shouldn't be too surprised that you have a whole section on cultivating relationships. And there's been a lot of evidence in the positive psychology literature linking strong social ties to longevity and happiness, right? How do relationships tie into our ability to cope with, quotes, the overwhelm?
Yeah, well, you've kind of just said it. The best predictor of a person's happiness and by some measures health and longevity as well is the breadth and the depth of our ties to other people, our social ties. And so going back to what we were talking about, the stress success tipping point, the easiest way to get our positive emotions up over three, you know, that ratio over 3 to 1 or at 3 to 1 is by cultivating love and compassion for other people. It's just, they're just our most powerful emotions. They create the biggest effect physiologically in us. And I mean, it ties directly back to what we were just talking about. So if you, you know, you need to signal to your brain that you're not in survival mode, that you're in a mode where you can be your most creative, intelligent, productive self, the way to do that is to care about other people, because that shifts you from individual survival mode to species survival, right? So if you signal to your brain, like, I have enough resources right now, not just to take care of myself, but to take care of others and to be concerned about others and to feel compassion. Compassion is a very powerful positive emotion, which is surprising to people. Then your brain shifts into this wonderful place of great expansiveness.
You know, that's an excellent place for us to wind down. I wonder if there's anything you'd like to add by way of summary.
Well, I will summarize and say that all of this does tie back to, you know, where in our lives we have the greatest ease and the greatest strength, right? And our relationships with other people bring us both great ease by signaling to our nervous system that we are safe and loved, and also great strength, right? Our greatest power comes from other people, the people who support us, the people who mentor us, the people who inspire us.
All right. Well, Dr. Christine Carter, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, it's been delightful. Thank you for having me.
In her book, Dr. Carter notes that overwork seems to be endemic to life in the United States. I'm under the impression that we work longer hours and take fewer and shorter vacations than other Western nations. In fact, Dr. Carter writes that for much of the 20th century, working more than 24 hours a week used to be viewed as stupid, wasteful, dangerous, and expensive, and a telling sign of dangerously incompetent management. I don't know about you, but even as a so-called retired person, I found a lot to reflect on in this conversation with Dr. Christine Carter. It's interesting that even though she had a head knowledge of how to take better care of herself, she was not putting that head knowledge to work in her own life until turning things around about 3 years ago. It's long been a rule of thumb for me that the things that people teach and advocate for others are often the very thing they are seeking in their own life. I know there are ways in which that's been true for me. I wonder if you listeners have observed something similar. My guess is that among the many people helpers in my listening audience, there might be more than a few who would do well to put more of their advice to others to work in their own lives. But hey, maybe I'm just projecting. As always, you can get this book using the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar. The title, once again, is The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Work and Home by Christine Carter, PhD.
Dr. Dave has given me many hours of interesting listening with his amazing podcasts. This week, I finally clicked on the support button on his website and sent a gift. Maybe you would like to send Dr. Dave a gift in this season of giving to show your appreciation for all his work. It feels good to give back to someone who gives so much. Think about it. It's worth doing.
Thank you, Carrie Schwartz, for that sterling testimonial and call to action. I sure hope it will inspire others to get their name up on the honor roll on our site by clicking on the multicolored donate button in the right-hand sidebar. And speaking of our donors, I'd like to publicly thank the latest ones to join our honor roll. They are Michael Son and Adam Marcus. And I'm especially grateful to all those who are donating on a monthly basis and Even though you don't get a thank you from me each month, I want you to know that I see your name and think of you each and every month as the PayPal reports come in. So let me take a moment right now to thank each of you, and I apologize for any butchering of names. So a big thank you to Peter Myron, Michael and Kathy O'Connor, Mustafa Sevik, Dalitz Media, Gloria Ullman, Life Career Studio, Alan Tabor, Marion Morgan, Manuel Lopez, Jean-Jacques Cossette, Louise Callahan, Mark Lundry, Gretchen Boger, Marilyn Morgan, Penny McMahon, Greg Nelson, John Eastman, Linda Schuler, Russell Davies, Mike Hackett, Michelle Nakagawa, Veronica Lacerida, Aero, Richard Blair, Matthew Robinson, Natasha LeBrock, Mary Stock, Sarah Loftus, Morgan Adolphson, Michael Ogden, Craig Moore, James Alexander, Selena Mitchell, Jennifer Green, Craig Moore, Sebastian Filzik, Stephen Fox, Simon Huggins, Ricky Bandekow, International Corporate Governance Society, Tony Johansson, Patricia Booker of Clear Sky Productions, Sarah Eagleton, Hink Smith, Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, Thomas V. Cliff, Tomas Petrowski, Sarah Graham, Lourdes Ritchie, Connections Counseling, Paul Krauss, Cynthia Perea Lira, Ronaldo Destri Demora, Roger Duncan, Henrietta Nicholson, Sorka McGrath, Christina Zeros, Carrie Schwartz, who we heard the message from just now, Marion International Party Limited, Henry Parshall, Julian Rote, Natural Connections Healthcare, Philippe Peacock, Doreen Baldridge, Paul Austin, Expertise, Carolyn Butcher, Stacy Simons, PhD, International Corporate Governance Society, Ricky Bandekow, Barbara Clark, Crystal Weber, Michael Sun, Adam Marcus, Richard and Linda Broward, Luke McMahon, Gwen Smith, Donna Raymond, Bradley Manning, Vicky Dunn, Jill Albrighton, James Percy, and Lynn Shiner. Thank you, one and all. Moving on to other things, let me remind you that you can receive a 15% discount on a DVD of a webinar with my recent guest, Imelda Godizar, who wrote the book on the life of Emma Jung. She did a webinar for our strategic partner, the Asheville Jung Center. Just go to www.ashevillejungcenter.org/RAP, that's R-A-P, for full details and your already discounted price of $16.95. And speaking of webinars, you can sign up for the webinar series with my recent guest, Maladoma Somme, the West African shaman, who's offering a 4-session course through the Jung platform. The cost is $99, including audio recording, but you can get a discount of 15% upon checkout using the code Dr. Dave, which is D-R-D-A-V-E. Just go to jungplatform.com to find that program. Finally, any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, let me recommend a book relevant to today's interview with Dr. Christine Carter, who's been so visibly affiliated with the positive psychology movement. Well, no one is more affiliated with that than its founder, Dr. Martin Seligman. On Audible.com, you can listen to an abridged version of his book, What You Can Change and What You Can't, Using the New Positive Psychology to Realize Your Potential for Lasting Fulfillment. And that's by Martin Seligman, and it's also narrated by Martin Seligman. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not to your taste, they have 165,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is UCLA psychiatry professor Dr. Gary Small, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Gary Small, who was my guest on two previous episodes. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and this one is from Adam, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I've been enjoying your show for the past couple of months and wanted to contribute, but as I am in Japan, my Japan-based PayPal is not accepted. The following message gets displayed when I try to make a payment. Quotes, PayPal does not currently support donation payments from buyers in Japan. We apologize for any inconvenience this may cause. Close quote. He goes on to say, I use PayPal constantly and frequently receive and occasionally send payments to the U.S. So this is specifically because your PayPal is configured as a donation and because of whatever regulatory requirements exist here in Japan. Do you have a personal PayPal account? As I am in Japan, checks are not an option. By the way, I'm an MBA admissions coach and blogger and a student in an executive master's in consulting and coaching for change. Basically, he says in parentheses, clinical and organizational psychology at INSEAD. I'm not sure what that is, probably the Institute of something or other. He goes on to say, I've told my classmates, a diverse group of consultants, coaches, psychologists, business executives, entrepreneurs, and HR people from around the world about shrink wrap. I know he is probably tough to get access to, but have you ever tried interviewing Christopher Bolas? Anyway, love the podcast. Cheers. And that's from Adam in Japan. And first of all, Adam, thanks so much for helping to spread the word there among your fellow students in that coaching program. And thank you for your recommendation of Christopher Bolas, who I looked up on Wikipedia and discovered that he's a major figure in the psychoanalytic movement whom I had not heard of. So I think that's a good suggestion, one I very well may follow up on. And then finally, Adam was able to make a donation to Shrink Wrap Radio using my private PayPal account. So if anybody else runs into that problem, you can just send me money through PayPal, and on PayPal, use vannized@sonoma.edu, and I believe that will come directly to me if you do it through PayPal. So I better close with that one. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Christine Carter, for sharing her wisdom on finding our groove at home and work. My next interview will be with return guest Gary S. Bobroff, M.A., and we'll be discussing his work on archetypal typology. So I hope you'll join us then, and until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.